You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 55, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to the show. So hope everybody had a good holiday weekend this week. For those of you who may not be listening as the show comes out new, this has just been the Memorial Day weekend, and as a result of that, amazingly enough, I'm running a little bit behind. However, one of the big events of this Memorial Day weekend is that we went to go see The Avengers. Now, I do have quite a lot to say about the movie, and because I do have quite a lot to say about it, I'm going to talk about it next week. And the reason why is because I just saw it, and I want to have a chance to think about it a bit. I will say right off the bat, I loved the movie. Great movie. And I knew that it was going to be a great movie because, generally speaking, I know a lot of people who like movies, and not all of them are comic book people, but do get a lot of feedback from the people around me who do see movies and generally get a sense, before I see anything, because I'm usually one of the last people to see anything, we'll get a pretty good general idea of how that movie is, how people are reacting to it, etc. And everybody seemed to love The Avengers, so I didn't have a lot of doubt going in that it was going to be a good, solid movie. But it really was very good. And like I said, we'll talk about it next time. We have been kind of had a lot of special episodes going on and so forth, and I'm just kind of looking forward to having an episode where we just kind of blow through the reviews and get some of that done. It seems like a long time since we've actually sat down and just done a couple comics. And that's what this episode is going to be. So without further ado, let's move on to our reviews.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder.
All right, so first this week we're going to be covering Baldur the Brave number one. Now, I told you we were going to do this last time because several months ago we were covering Thor, and I think I mentioned that Baldur had gone off to the Norn realm and made note of that in our narrative. And so the continuity is a little bit glitchy here because they actually had talked about this. Okay, this is where Baldur the Brave number one happens, something like 7 or 8 months before the miniseries actually came out. And indeed, in the Hell storyline that we had just finished talking about here on the show, where Baldur comes back, it actually takes place between Baldur the Brave number one and number two. So here's where we kind of get the continuity back into sequence. And so for the next 4 weeks, we're going to be covering the Baldur the Brave miniseries in lieu of a Simonson issue. So anyway, we start out with Baldur the Brave number one. It has a cover date of November 1985, retail for 75 cents. Has a cover by Walt Simonson, and showing Baldur the Brave, who's dressed in this really elaborate samurai-looking armor. This is the same armor that he was wearing in the last couple issues of Thor, incidentally. And he's fighting against these sort of demon-looking soldiers with these big long halberds, and he's kind of jumping over them and swinging a sword. And in the back, we have an image of Carnilla, kind of with her hands behind her head and her arms raised up to show off her tits, and looking very, you know, seductive, as Carnilla often does. And we open up to the splash page where we get a little bit of a prologue. And it's actually seemingly unrelated to the story, though I'm sure it comes into play, of course. A story about the god Frey and falling in love with this goddess named Gerd. And he calls his friend Skirnir to him and gives Skirnir this magic sword as a token of his esteem. The sword makes you unconquerable, and Skirnir instead goes to Gerd and decides that he's going to have her for himself and decides to keep the magic sword. So Fry has been betrayed by his friend, obviously. And so they show that Skirnir is sleeping in his bed and somebody's stealing his sword because, you know, even though the sword makes you unconquerable in battle, it doesn't prevent itself from being stolen. So the sword disappears and they have show the sword sitting on the sort of altar glowing and the caption says, "Perhaps Odin, ruler of the gods, knew of the sword's fate, but the one-eyed god is gone. And now, unknown to any save its owner, the sword rests with an impregnable armory cut from the living rock, deep beneath the ancient fastness in the wilds, a fortress called Norn Keep, home of the sorceress Carnilla, otherwise known as the Norn Queen." And we have the title of the story here, and it's called The Sword of Fry. Written by Walter Simonson, illustrated by Sal Buscema, lettered by John Workman Jr., colored by Paul Beckton, edited by Ralph Macchio, and the editor-in-chief, as always, is Jim Shooter. And we open up the story with Balder, and he's still Fat Balder at this point. He hasn't lost all the weight yet. And he's on the roof of the Norn Queen's castle, and the Norn Queen is there, and she's kind of lounging around on this silver futon-looking thing. And Balder's little woodland friends are gathered around, well, the birds at least, and they're eating bird seed out of his hand, and Carnilla is saying, "It's been a long time since birds have come and eaten here," and Balder says, "Well, it's because he's friendlier to the birds than she is, etc., etc., blah, blah, blah." And then they are paid a visit by Whiteface, the father of the eagles, and I guess he comes to tell Balder what's going on in Asgard. And Carnilla says to him, "How is it, Balder, that the birds do not come close to my hand?" And Balder says, "Perhaps the birds are no one's fools, Carnilla." "And what, pray tell, my noble warrior, does that make you?" And the eagle goes flying off, going, "Scree, screek!" Because one of Carnilla's demon servants is arriving on the scene. This is Gothog. And he's this green, hunchbacked, orc-looking thing with a purple tunic and sort of blue pixie boots. And like, "My mistress, a word with you, a moment." "Very well, Gothog, but there had best be a good reason for this interruption." And Gothog whispers something to Carnilla, and she's a little bit surprised by this. So she excuses herself, and Balder offers his assistance, but she says, "Nay, my warrior, this is no threat to the realm, but merely a minor annoyance." And she, as she goes off, she's thinking to herself that it's a minor annoyance that threatens to destroy the idol that she has sought to surround the noble Balder with. And it turns out that it's Agnar, and you remember him from the earlier episodes of the Simonson Thor as the warrior who was going to try to kill Balder, but ended up being like a Balder worshiper and is following him around like a little lost puppy. And that's who that is. And he's riding off into the Norn realm. And we saw this actually happen. Thor sent him after Balder back at the beginning of this storyline where Thor wanted to go to Hel. And because Balder was the only one who had been to Hel and back and survived to talk about it, he wanted Balder along and he sent Agnar after him. So this is where this happens. And Carnilla notices that Agnar is coming along and she's spying on him through her super voyeuroscope. In this case, it's like a big pink crystal ball. And she's thinking he can only have come from Asgard seeking his liege lord. And should he reach him, Balder will learn that I have neglected to tell him of the disappearance of Odin from the Golden Realm. Yeah, that has happened some time ago now. And she reckons that if Balder finds out that Odin is missing, he would want to immediately hurry back to Asgard. And so she decides she's going to have her demon serpents kidnap Agnar and hold him prisoner. So we see Agnar riding through like this canyon, like in a Western, you know, comic or Western TV show, and he gets ambushed, and the demons capture Agnar and bring him before Carnilla. And has an audience here with him. And she's, again, as always, she's sprawled out on this sort of futon-looking thing. I guess she has an inordinate fondness for futons. And Carnilla says to Agnar, "Forgive my having had you brought to the Norn Keep through the crypts, my young blade. But I have many enemies who wear guises far fairer than thine. Why have you come to the Norn realm?" "You must not detain me. I have come with a message of great urgency from Thor himself. It's imperative that Balder return to Asgard at once." And for some reason, he decides he's going to give the message to Carnilla. which doesn't make any sense at all, but he tells her what's going on. Thor is about to embark on a mission of the deadliest nature, and he craves the noble Baldur's presence. Alas, young sir, I fear your speech is all gibberish to me, and she casts a spell on him, and he gets knocked out, and she says, when you awake, gibberish is all you will be able to utter, for Baldur must never learn of thy mission here from thee. And she orders her demon servants to take Agnar down into the dungeons, and decides to spare his life. He says, though I do not dare slay Agnar for fear of Thor's wrath, should he learn of his messenger's death, I will play for time until Thor has left. And then, with a little persuading, Agnar shall be made to believe that he was never in the Norn Keep at all. Now pitch him into my deepest dungeon, but mark you, keep him fed and secure till I call for him. And she goes back out to where Baldur's waiting, and Baldur is playing with his little birdie friends, and she's saying, ah, Baldur, please forgive my absence from your side. My little friends have kept me amused, Carnoa, and have you settled the matter of your visitor? How did you know? A little bird told me. And she says, I thought only the walls had ears. He was simply some itinerant tradesman seeking work. I have dismissed him, which is about as transparent a lie as you're going to get. And they cut to the dungeons. It says hours later, and we see Agnar laying in the dungeon. He's like, oh, my head, what's happened? I can't remember my name. There was a beautiful woman, and I had something important I had to say to someone. And then, and you hear a scragoon, and food drops from the ceiling, and he tries speaking out loud, trying to talk to the person, whoever opened this door, trying to talk to whoever dropped the food down. And the words come out as gibberish, and he says, Kragugert, right? Is this beg right? So, yeah. So he realizes that he can't speak clearly, a bit like me, actually. And he's picked up the food, and he's eating it. Is whatever my enemies have in store for me, they don't mean for me to starve to death. And he says, the water tastes good, no matter who's providing it, I suppose. And then some rats are coming around trying to eat his food, and he gets mad, and he throws this glass of water at the rats with a kring, and they go running away. And he's thinking, filthy creatures, and yet mayhap I have acted too hastily, for am I not the same as they? Yeah, I guess he is a rat, right? Lost, alone, a mere speechless, brutish thing. And I seem to remember another, a gentle being who called animals of every kind friend. I can almost see his face before me, he thinks of Baldur. Someone I must have known, respected, perhaps even loved. Oh my. We then cut back to Baldur and the Norn Queen, and they're having a dinner at, not really fancy table, but, the two of them are having dinner or whatever. And Baldur is complimenting her on the wine, and he's guessing that the wine was procured from beyond the shores of Ringsfjord. I suppose the implication here is that any wine that comes from closer than Ringsfjord really sucks, and this is really good wine, so it had to have come from further. And Carnoa says, with the passing of days, brave Baldur, you may yet have a chance to sample the myriad delights of my entire cellar. And as time means nothing to such as we, who knows what rare and wondrous vintages we may yet encounter. And we cut back to Agnar in the dungeon, and he's, I guess time has passed, though that's not very clear from the story, but apparently some time has passed, days at least. And he's talking to the rats, and how long, my little ones? How long? That's a rather personal question. In this never-changing twilight, I have lost all track of days. But as time passes, more and more of your kindred join us and share our meager rations. Yeah, you feed rats and they multiply. That's why. he's feeding the rats and they're creating more rats. And anyway, I guess he's not lonely anyway. And he sees bats fluttering around in the ceiling. And it seems like he really shouldn't be able to see that in the dark. But okay, anyway, he's Asgardian or whatever, so he can do that. And he's kind of thinking that he feels the sense of urgency slipping away, but he can't remember why he's really there. And we cut back to Carnoa and Baldur, and they're riding horses, frolicking merrily through a very bright, piss-yellow landscape. And when I say that, I mean the ground is yellow, the sky is yellow, the trees are yellow, everything is yellow. It's like Carnoa took a giant piss all over everything. And yet, Carnilla is talking about how the Norn realm has never been so green and so beautiful. Well, it looks yellow to me. And Carnilla says, someday, I would like to understand how you wrap the sunshine around you and warm the very earth. And Baldur says, "The sun is in the heart, m'lady, and you have always sheathed yours in the frosts of winter." "Then perhaps you will help me melt the sheath and lie in the sunshine, m'lord." "Oh, my." That's not suggestive at all, is it? "What say you, Baldur?" "Baldur?" "Forgive me, my lady. From this high promontory, I feel I can almost see all the way home to Asgard." And as he's saying that, he's gazing off into the yellow sky. "And one day, there I must return." "Why should you, my brave warrior? Everything you want is here with me." And we cut back to Agnar in the crypt here, and he's feeding the rats again and sharing his meals with them, huddled in the darkness. And he's talking to the bats. He's feeding the bats out of his hand, which makes no sense because, you know, bats generally don't eat people food. You know, they generally fly around to catch insects because that's what bats do. So this is just a storytelling problem. Either that or they have some weird-ass bats in the Norn realm, and I guess you can blame it on that. So anyway, so he's envying the bats because they can come and go as they please and fly around, etc., etc. And he's thinking about how he envies them. It says, "How easily you may escape this place and fly free, though you shun the light and leave us in our darkness and despair." And the bat goes flying up through the castle, and it goes, "Squee, squee!" And Baldur sees the bat, and he's like, "A bat? A bat in daylight? It's an omen. I shall become a bat." And Baldur the Brave turns into Batman. And that's the end of the story. No, sorry, that doesn't happen. So the bat comes and it lands on Baldur's shoulder and is talking to him in its little squeaky bat language. And Baldur's talking to it, saying, "What errand of urgency has brought you out of the Stygian depths to seek the light and Baldur?" And it takes off Baldur's shoulder and says, "Be off, Baldur shall follow thee without fail." And the bat guides him through the various caverns and through the dungeons. And there's a guard keeping, yeah, I guess, guard over Agnar's cell. But Baldur is able to be able to sneak past the guards. And the bat leads him on to the trap door where they drop the food down to Agnar. And Baldur looks down and he sees Agnar down the bottom. And he's, "Agnar, Agnar." And Agnar is speaking gibberish back up. And Baldur realizes that he's speaking gibberish because of Carnilla's magic, and he tells Agnar to stand away from the door, and even though Baldur is not as strong as Thor, a metal door is no match for him, and he tears up this metal hatch and drops a rope down to let Agnar climb up and says, "Now we shall see what a mere itinerant tradesman has to say with his power of speeches restored." And we then cut to Carnilla's throne room, and she's there sitting on her throne, and she's got her big pointy hat on, and standing next to her is her evil old lady assistant, Hag. And she's being, I guess, petitioned by these monster, Skeksis lizard-looking people who live in her realm and doing her Norn Queen-type stuff. And she's dispensing justice, according to the caption. Anyway, she says, "Thy plea is granted, Nashnath. This toad's head shall be thine."
"Your majesty is gracious to her humble servant."
"But should you fail to produce the Vergeld, the toad shall feast upon thine eyes. Have him removed from the court, hag." They are interrupted by the door bashing in and the guards going flying and Baldur shouting out, "Stand aside!" And interrupts the proceedings and he says, "Greetings, gracious queen."
"What is the meaning of this intrusion, Baldur?"
"I have come to seek the queen's justice, for I have found the itinerant tradesman, and I am sure that you can help him." "Very sure." And he presents Agnar to Carnilla. Says, "He seems to have lost the power to speak clearly. I told him I was certain Carnilla, the beautiful and gracious Norn queen, could restore it." And she orders Hag to get all the other creatures out of her throne room. "Now." And everyone goes running. And she's like, "Did another little bird speak to you?" And Baldur says, "Yeah, more or less." "Stand aside, Agnar. It will only sting for a moment." And Carnilla kisses Agnar, and he's have like a flash of light above his head. He goes, "Urk, my voice, I can speak again, and I remember everything. My lady, I. And Baldur says, "And here, Carnilla, I thought your kisses were only for me. She is a wonder, is she not, lad? Now come, Agnar, clear your troubled brow, and tell me why you have sought me out from the fabled halls of Asgard." "Have you not heard, my lord? Odin, the Allfather, has passed on. He and his mortal enemy, Surtur, fell together into the fiery depths and have been seen no more." And that happened back in Thor 353, for those of you who are keeping track. And, of course, Baldur is upset by that. "The Allfather gone! And you did not tell me, Carnilla.
To what end? 'Twas beyond your power to aid him in that final moment, or mine. Better to stand in the sun than to cry in the dark. I did tell thee, Baldur, everything you want is here with me. And Agnar tells Baldur what Thor has sent him to tell him. Says, my lord Thor has bid you come back and return to the realm eternal, for he plans a foray into hell, and only Baldur the Brave hath journeyed there and returned to tell the tale. He needs the aid that only you can provide. What possible reason could Thor have for riding the dark way into death? Hela, the ruler of hell, has stolen mortal souls to which he has no right, and Thor has sworn to free them or perish in the attempt. Yes, Thor would try to save them, wouldn't he? And you would not, Baldur? And Carnilla's trying to stop Baldur from leaving. She says, do not do this thing, my lord. What are a few mortal souls to such as we? Of all the living, I alone know the cost of the enterprise Thor is undertaking. He may yet wish he had died by his father's side, but he is right. The realm of Hela is perilous and awful beyond words, and no mortal who has not earned that death should taste it. I will return to Asgard with you, Agnar. And Carnilla's saying, that journey will not be easy, Lord Baldur. But from the journey to hell, even you may not return. And Agnar is kind of shocked by this behavior from Carnilla, saying, my lord, forgive my impertinence, but that is, I mean, why do you stay with the Queen of the Norns, Agnar? You do not know her as I do. There is a great deal more to Carnilla than just the thwarted queen. I am disappointed that she did not tell me about Odin, but of course she was right. I would have returned to Asgard long since and left her behind had I known. And in a sense, Carnilla imprisoned you with my best interests at heart. What woman who loved a man would want to see him enter hell under any circumstances? The queen was simply prepared to do more about it than most. I, who have already been there and survived, can hardly face the thought of entering its dank portals yet again. But can I refuse my aid to mortals who languish in such horror? How long before Thor's expedition rides for hell? And Agnar tells us he's leaving at the end of the month, and the heroes of Valhalla will be ready by then. And Baldur's like, oh, then we have just the time we need. The last time I was in hell, I was in fighting Trim, and I barely escaped with my life. So come, Agnar. We must needs be physically ready for the task ahead. And so they kind of imply at this point that Baldur's really not spending much time with Carnilla. And Carnilla's in her chamber, lying on her cushions and futons, and Hag is there, and the little troll carrying her wine around, And she's saying, I should have had Agnar slain ere he came within the walls of Nornkeep. But could I have kept the news about Odin from Baldur forever? Oh, Baldur, would that I had never seen thy blinding image before mine eyes. I am so afraid for thee. And she doesn't look very afraid for him. She looks kind of pissed, actually. And Hag is standing behind her going, even now, Hag, I have within my castle the means that might save him from Hela's arms a second time. And yet, can I give up so priceless a treasure of the Sword of Frey, even to Baldur? So this is where our prologue comes into play. He is no mean warrior, but one of the finest in any realm. Would he even need such a weapon? And she's kind of looking out over the courtyard of the castle, and Baldur and Agnar are training down there. And she says, and still, he and Agnar continue their ceaseless practice outside in the courtyard. And we cut back to where Baldur and Agnar are practicing. He says, well struck, my young friend. Now try again. And this time, hold nothing back. And the two of them are sparring and so forth. And we have a little training montage. Yeah, right out of Rocky. You know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. And they're sword fighting practice. And Baldur, generally speaking, is out fighting Agnar. And yeah, they're playing target practice, throwing axes at targets, and they're lifting rocks. And you see that Baldur now is not Fat Baldur anymore, and he's now Muscular Baldur again. And it shows them jogging and running through the Norn realm and jumping over cliffs and chopping up targets with their swords and weightlifting and all that fun stuff. And so finally they're ready, and he says, the hour has come, Agnar. Once more, 'tis time to take up the toys of war and ride boldly off into the waiting arms of the fates. And in the space of that sentence, he says, once more, this time to take up the toys of war. And the second half of the sentence, they have managed to be dressed in their full armor and are leaving the kingdom. So apparently Baldur has the ability to get dressed at super speed. They're in the courtyard of the castle, and the Carnilla's demon guards are there, and they're kind of skulking around. And Baldur's horse is there, and he says, hail, Silverhoof, Carnilla has been a good hostess to you, my steed. Never has your coat shone so in the morning sun. Never have you looked so beautiful. I bet he tells Carnilla the same thing, actually. So even now Balder can spare a thought for the queen of the land as only a stable hand, fit to curry the horses, but not fit to speak of the heroes that ride them.
Like she is currying the horses herself. Yeah, I don't think so.
You would do better to look to me for help than be off so hurriedly to the kingdom of death. I'm sorry, my queen, that you view our leave-taking so harshly, but you would love me even less if I did not ride with Thor to a splendid doom. And I shall love you not at all when you fail to return. How different, pray tell, would that be from the past week?
You speak nasty to the great queen, says one of the guards, and death to the queen's enemies, and attacks Balder.
Of course, Balder easily turns the guard aside, pushes him down and into the dirt, and turns to the guard and says, come, my friend, let me return your spear and your good humor. And Carnilla is outraged. How dare you attack without orders, dog? Must I teach you your place?
And Baldur's like, no, spare him, Carnilla, for my sake. He but attacked out of love for his mistress. But tell me, did you not speak of help a moment ago? What does a warrior need who can so easily defeat one of my picked guards? Carnilla has nothing that would aid such a mighty fighter.
What about your blessing to take with us to the darkest realms of death? No? Then you shall have mine.
May thy sheath of ice melt before the sun returns. Fare you well, my queen. And they go riding off, and as they leave sight, she decides she's going to kill the guard anyway, and blast him with a magical bolt, with a shazap. His dog, what that is, you have harmed my Balder. Now be gone, all of you. And the sun is setting, and Carnilla is sitting here and thinking to herself, may the Norns guide you, sweet warrior, and bring you back safely to me. And we have a next issue blurb. Be here next time for Balder the Betrayed.
All right, so that was Balder the Brave number one. Not real impressed. I mean, I like Walt Simonson's writing. I really do. But I think that in this particular case, the artwork is really not up to the storytelling. Now, I've said in the past, Sal Buscema is not my favorite artist. You know, he is kind of consistently the second-tier Marvel artist. But there's a number of things about the artwork that I really don't like. First of all, is the basic storytelling sense is not as good as it should be. It's never really clear of exactly how much time has passed between the different scenes. And even in between panels on the same page, like where we have Agnar in the tomb, I mean, we're given reason to believe that it's been weeks that he's been down here, but it actually, the time passes between panels. We clearly have scenes that are taking place at the same time in a different place, but it's not clear from the artwork or the script that this is going on. There's not the captions here to explain these things in more depth. There's a few little niggling things like the bat eating out of Agnar's hand. Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, obviously he's not carrying insects around for bats to eat. Now, one big thing that gets me is that I don't think that it's ever really been established in the past that Balder can talk to animals. We know that everything alive loves Balder because we got that from the myths. We got the fact that Balder was beloved by all of nature. All of nature took a vow. But I don't think the myth ever says that Balder can talk to birds. So that becomes a little bit of a problem because you think about it. If Balder could talk to birds and he's periodically communicating with animals, obviously Carnilla didn't know about this because apparently the first she finds out about this is when he tells her that the little birdie told him about Agnar. So why hasn't he heard about Odin from one of his birdie friends? Now, it could be the birdies just don't give a shit about what's going on in Asgard. I suppose that makes sense. I mean, you know, he's not their Allfather, but he's the Allfather. That would be big news even for the birds, you'd think. And if not the birds, at least the eagle who has been coming to visit him. So if Balder can talk to birds, why send Agnar at all? Why not send a bird who can fly a lot faster than Agnar can ride? So this is, to me, this is a hole in the storytelling and something that I really kind of just can't get past. So what the hell? I think that that's kind of a major hole in the story here. Anyway, yeah, so I remember when this came out back in 85 that I was a little bit disappointed in this as well back then. Now, I happen to know that the story does get better. So in this case, I'm going to give it a pass. And, well, of course, we'll be back next week with part two of this.
and continue on with this. But anyway, it is an important sort of character development story for Baldur, and maybe even for Carnilla, who at this point has been the sort of ambivalent character in Thor. I mean, sometimes she's bad, sometimes she acts on the side of the gods. Basically, she's out for her own interest. She's the sort of female anti-hero of Asgard, and that's all fine and good. So, the good stuff. Anyway, so let's move on then to the next issue that we are covering this week. And that issue is Thor number 142. Has a cover date of July of 1967, retailed for 12 cents. Incidentally, this issue has been reprinted in The Essential Thor Volume 3 and also in Marvel Masterworks Thor Volume 6. Cover art is by Jack Kirby and Vinnie Coletta, and on the cover we see Thor, and he's fighting this pointy-shouldered alien green dude on top of a building. And this alien guy has this weird cross-eyed look that makes him look really goofy on the cover. Now, we recognize him. If you're a Marvel fan, of course, from a long time back, you will recognize this character as a Skrull. And not just any Skrull, but the cover blurbs identify him as the Super Skrull. From the edge of infinity he comes, possessing all the blockbusting powers of the Fantastic Four. And, of course, the powers of the Fantastic Four, for those of you who may not know that, are catching on fire, burning, throwing fire, that kind of thing, turning invisible, generating force fields, getting big, rocky, and strong, and stretching like a big rubber band. So those are the powers of the Fantastic Four in a nutshell. So that's all you really need to know about that. Anyway, on the cover, Thor is kind of grabbing onto the edge of a building, and the Super Skrull is standing atop it, and he is torn off a big chunk of the brickwork of the building. It looks like he's getting ready to pound Thor with it. And we open up to the splash page, and we have the title of the story, The Scourge of the Super Skrull, a modern majestic masterwork by Stan the Man Lee and Jack King Kirby, embellished by Vinnie Coletta and lettered by Art Simic. And we open up the story with a motorcyclist taunting Thor because he thinks that he is faster than Thor and challenges Thor to a race. And Thor, because he just feels like mocking this guy, accepts. And there's even a note here that Thor really isn't blocking traffic by standing in the middle of the road. Why would they mention that now? After all of those Journey into Mystery issues where Thor is just standing in the middle of the road at random, why would they pick now to give the excuse that, according to New York City law, official vehicles and thunder gods have the right of way? Well, that's just Stan Lee trying to be funny, I guess. So anyway, this punk on the motorcycle is like, well, if it ain't the so-called thunder god, how about a race, Curly? I bet I can run rings around you if I ever let this baby open up. The mighty Thor challenged to a test of speed by a mortal cyclist? It doth truly strike my fancy. Therefore, I do say, so be it. And Thor grabs the handlebars of the motorcycle, and he says, but I fear there could be much danger in speeding through heavy local traffic. Perhaps there is another way. And the motorcycle's like, yeah, you're trying to chicken out. Hey, what are you doing? Let go of my handlebars. And Thor jumps on the bike in front of him and starts swinging the hammer around, and he's driving the motorcycle because obviously Thor knows how to ride a motorcycle. Maybe he learned that skill from Don Blake, who, raced motorcycles in his spare time or something. But Thor says, do not be alarmed. I merely wish to demonstrate that the God of Thunder does not chicken out. We shall find an area where we may race in safety. And the motorcycle kid is like, look out with that hammer. Don't. You're lifting us into the air like a whirly bird. Yeah, because anything that spins flies. Remember that. That's very important when you're dealing with the Jack Kirby comic. And the motorcycle goes flying up because Thor's whirling his hammer around like a helicopter. And the motorcycle guy is horrified. He said, come on, cut it out. Get us down. Can't you even take a joke? And Thor's like, the question is, can you? I shall bring thee to a place where we may match our speed in company with meteors and blazing comets. And should thy cycle prove victorious, you shall be awarded with the Asgardian Wreath of Heroes. And they're way up in the sky above New York City, and the kid's like, it ain't possible. We're almost in orbit. You got us up here in no time flat. Look, I don't want a wreath. Honest, I was only kidding. I just want one thing. I want to get down again in one piece. And Thor is laughing at him because Thor likes to mock the feeble-minded. And they come back down to Earth, and he's like, I didn't mean it so fast. And Thor comes to a screeching stop on the street in New York City, causing a traffic hazard, no doubt. And he goes, but alas, our epic race hath not yet been concluded. How then shall we know which of us is the faster? Don't worry, mister. I know now. Hoo boy, how I know. Thou shalt have much to relate to thy friends. But what good'll it do? They'll never believe me. Well, you know, there was the witnesses, all the people standing around in the street when Thor took off with his motorcycle. Remember, ever youthful one, speed, like time, is merely relative. But now the God of Thunder must return to his mortal pursuits. I must needs find a secluded area, and then by striking my hammer upon the ground, I am instantly transformed. He's saying all this out loud, so that anybody around knows his secret identity. I'm instantly transformed to the quiet, all-too-human Dr. Don Blake, who desires no greater adventure than healing the sick and afflicted. And we then cut to the next scene, and we come across Loki. And Loki is, according to the caption, far, far beyond the reaches of our own universe. And he's on this weird planetoid sort of thing, and there's this weird rock formation that looks like tentacles, and yeah, very Jack Kirby-ish. Kind of awesome looking, actually. This is a pretty cool page. And very nicely inked, I have to say, after the last issue. This is looking pretty good. And Loki is whining because he's been left here on this planetoid, and yeah, Thor has deposited him, apparently. And he's like, "'Tis because of my cursed half-brother, the unmentionable Thor, that I am sentenced to this life which is less than life. I, who am the most cunning, the most crafty, the most cruel of all who wear the mantle of immortality. I, who by right of birth should be most favored. But instead I endure the most loathsome of punishments because of my ignoble defeat at the hands of the Thunder God. Still, the Prince of Evil is never truly vanquished. Lo, these long and tortuous months I have planned and schemed, and now at last the time has come. The time for Loki to have his inevitable revenge upon him who I despise. For though the body of Loki be herewith imprisoned, my mind may roam the universe at will. Now, where have we seen this before? This is exactly the same plot we had back in Journey into Mystery when Loki was tied to a rock in Asgard and he had to cause trouble by casting his mind to Earth. I'm sure you remember. If you don't, go back and listen to the old Radio Free Asgard shows and you will find it. And after countless days and nights of searching, I have found the one who shall be my instrument of revenge. We see that Loki has sent out his astral form because, you know, all the good mystical characters in the Marvel Universe can send out their spirit and it flies around like Casper the Friendly Ghost and it can go kind of anywhere. And we see Loki's astral form going to this very elaborate Kirby-ish spaceship, and we'll never see that again, I'm sure. And he's thinking, here within the furthermost reaches of the far-off Skrull Galaxy, within a lonely survey ship, is a virtual exile like myself, one whose power may prove equal to the task. He is known as the Super Skrull. Now, how would he know that? Obviously, Loki's been reading the Fantastic Four, because the Super Skrull actually appeared in the Fantastic Four number 18, which at this point was some years ago. So, I mean, this is, been a while since the Super Skrull appeared. Specially bred and trained to defeat the mortal Fantastic Four many years ago. So not only does he know who he knows his backstory as well. When success had seemed within his very grasp, he failed, and thus has been sentenced to patrol the endless skyways of nowhere. But when he battled on Earth before, he did not have the wicked wizardry of Loki to aid him. This time there shall be a different result against a different foe. All I need to do is plant the proper thought within his unsuspecting brain, and he's on board the Super Skrull ship, and you know, thankfully the Super Skrull is wearing his Super Skrull costume, because people just kind of wander around with their superhero costumes on, and he's whispering to the Super Skrull mentally, "You can still redeem yourself to the world of Skrulls. If you defeat the God of Thunder, then Asgard itself might be invaded by the Skrull legions. An immortal Loki, the Prince of Evil, would battle at thy side. Consider the greatness, the grandeur, the glory that would be thine." And the Super Skrull understands what he's heard, and he turns his ship around and heads towards Earth. And Loki's there shaking his fist and says out loud, "He streaks for Earth! I have succeeded!" So apparently he removed his uniform. "Thunder God, look to thy laurels. Thy greatest test is yet to come."
And we then cut scenes to Earth, and it says seconds later, cosmic time-wise, that is. So, in other words, they just didn't want to show the journey to Earth. Obviously, it took weeks to get there. And the Super Skrull arrives on Earth, and he leaves his ship, apparently able to fly in space. And he's saying,
"My ship will remain in orbit, and I will enter Earth's atmosphere using my force field like a re-entry capsule."
Yeah, so he's using... that's kind of clever, actually. I can see that. And once he enters the atmosphere, he uses the Human Torch's power to fly around the way the Human Torch does. And he's going to use his flaming power to attract the attention of Thor. And he goes into the middle of the street, apparently in New York City, and he melts a truck. And somebody's yelling, "It's the Human Torch! He's gone mad!" "No, it's not the Torch! It's someone else with the same power!
He melted that abandoned truck in one simple fiery burst."
That is not, folks, an abandoned truck. It's right in the middle of traffic. Unless it was abandoned, like, really recently, like when it started to melt.
"He's shouting something. It's a challenge. Where is the God of Thunder? Why does he not appear? If it's Thor he wants, somebody get him. Hurry."
And at that moment, of course, Don Blake just happens to be watching out the window because, you know, these coincidences happen all the time. I think Don Blake actually situated his office in a place where supervillains always attack so that he can always just see them out the window as he's taking care of his patients.
"It's the Super Skrull, exactly as described by the old newspaper reports. He's far too dangerous to blaze through the city that way unchecked. He must be stopped. And he shall be stopped. By the mighty Thor!" And he bangs his hammer on the floor, changes to Thor.
Though we don't see that, we just see the window glowing in his office. And Thor comes out of the window and goes after the Super Skrull. And he's,
"Back, thou merciless alien monstrosity!"
I can only hear that in a Dr. Smith voice.
"Oh, back, thou merciless alien monstrosity! Get ye back before the bludgeoning mallet of the God of Thunder!"
No, okay, that's enough of that.
"Huh, my intended victim has dared to accept my challenge. Once I have slain you, I will again be acclaimed as master of all." "I say thee never. If fire be thy most potent weapon, then we must needs have an end to it. So saith Thor," and Thor flings his hammer at the Super Skrull.
And he's doing the sort of Ajax White Tornado thing where his hammer is spinning around the Super Skrull at super speed. And meanwhile, Thor's falling out of the sky. Nice point there, because we know that Thor can't actually fly without the hammer, so he actually should be falling. And the Super Skrull's like,
"He's created a whirlwind, deadening my flame. Think you the son of Odin may be so cavalierly threatened with impunity? Thy flame is extinguished," and the hammer turns to Thor, and the Super Skrull goes crashing to the ground.
And Thor says, "Now shalt thou face the might of Thor. Now shall be the final reckoning." And Super Skrull says,
"Yes, the reckoning now is due, but not the way you expect. I possess the power of each member of the Fantastic Four. Since you have deprived me of the Human Torch's flame, I shall employ the shattering strength of the unstoppable thing."
And you see him turning orange and rock-like, the way the thing is. I have to point out here that both the Super Skrull and Thor's costumes have pointy shoulders. So this is sort of the battle for whoever has the biggest pointy shoulders, I guess. And the Super Skrull lifts up the top of a building, which seems a bit impossible. Since he's standing on the building next door, and he's not that big. And let's chalk that up to artistic license.
"Once before, due to my abysmal carelessness, I was forced to taste the bitter dregs of defeat. But now I am wiser, more cautious, and infinitely more powerful," as you can easily see, infinitely is spelled wrong here. "He doth lift the very wall from yonder roof with a strength within his own two arms. That is why the Super Skrull cannot lose. This is why the God of Thunder must surely be destroyed."
And he takes this giant piece of the building that he just ripped up, and he flings it at Thor, and it crashes past Thor with a mighty batoom, and Thor manages to dodge it. It says here,
"You've saved yourself by releasing your hold and plummeting down."
That doesn't look like what's happening. It looks like he's just dodging it.
"But you will not be so lucky the next time."
And we then cut back to Asgard. Incidentally, this is a fantastic panel here of the building crashing past Thor. It's just such a classic, dynamic, beautiful Kirby panel. It's really stunning. This is a page I would love to have, actually. So
We then cut scenes to Asgard, and we have Odin looking kind of unlike Odin. He doesn't look like Santa Claus either. He just kind of looks weird. And he's in his throne room, and there's a blue-caped figure before him who we find out is Baldur. And Baldur says, "I've come, Omnipotent One, in answer to thy royal summons.
Mine eyes are pleased to gaze on thee again, noble Baldur. Too long hast thou been absent from this court. Now be thou attentive, loyal one, as Odin tells thee of thy mission. The deadly enchanters have been discovered in Ringsfjord."
That's where that wine came from, isn't it? Apparently that is the border where from, like, the bad wine and the good wine, if you remember the prior issue we just talked about. So this is the second mention of Ringsfjord on the show.
"They must be found, and their plans be made known to me," because Omnipotent Odin can't use his cosmic voyeuroscope to spy there, apparently. "But have a care, brave Baldur. Though you're immune to death by natural means, the enchanters may still slay thee."
"The enchanters? Creatures of evil whose power almost equals thine own. In the service of my liege sire, I know no fear." And then Sif comes up next to Baldur and says, "My lord, I crave permission to accompany him who is friend of Thor. The land of Ringsfjord is well known to me, and I may serve as guide."
"The Lady Sif."
"I beg thee, fair one, reconsider. Each step of the way shall be fraught with deadly peril, and you're just a girl." Anyway, Odin is looking at her and says,
"I bid thee rise, my child, as I weigh thy plea.
Thou dost seek to overcome thy loneliness, thy longing for Thor's return. But as the god of thunder is like unto a brother to Baldur, I cannot permit one whom he treasures so highly to take such a risk. Is not my arm as skillful as any warrior? Is my eye not as keen? Is my courage less true?" And from the background, as though an afterthought, we have Odin off-panel shouting,
"I rule for the Lady Sif. As noble of the realm, she doth possess the right to thus volunteer. So be it."
And that, I guess that settles the matter. And they set off on horseback for Ringsfjord. And Baldur's thinking while they're riding off how courageous and how gentle she is, and how Thor is so blessed for having won the love of Sif. So I think Baldur's a little jealous here, actually. Of course, he has little birdie friends to keep him company, I guess.
"Let us ride, then, noble lady. Whatever may befall, know ye that the limbs and the life of Baldur are ever at thy service."
And they go riding off. And we then come back to Earth, where Thor is hanging by his hammer off the side of a building, and Thor has managed to save himself from falling after getting the roof pitched at him by grabbing onto the edge of the roof with his hammer. And the Super Skrull stretches his arm out like Mr. Fantastic to reach out for Thor, and grabs Thor and swings him around and drags him to the building top where he's standing. And Thor is saying,
"In truth, I do battle a foe that doth possess the awesome abilities of four super-powered opponents. But no matter the odds, Thor shall not yield."
You know, but it's not like battling four people. You're battling one person who just happens to have four very specific power sets.
"You have no choice, Thunder God. You are hopelessly outmatched. See how I prevent you from employing your greatest weapon, merely by entangling your hammer-throwing arm with my own supple limb."
And he's got Thor all wrapped up in Mr. Fantastic's stretch arm, you know, in rubber arm. And Thor manages to just kind of stretch his way out of it, like pulling the hammer free. And he says,
"Now you see how the Thunder God doth make a mockery of thy power with but a single burst of immortal strength. You broke free by muscle power alone. Yield, creature of evil. Yield at Thor's command, or face the fateful consequence."
And he's drawing his hammer back as though he's going to smash the Super Skrull. And he does actually strike at him, and the hammer destroys the chimney on the building with a giant throck. But the Super Skrull manages to stretch out of the way, and he goes,
"Huh! Once again, the stretching power of Reed Richards has saved me. And now it is I who will attack."
Yeah, because you want to announce your attack to Thor. And Thor's like, "Okay, attack a schmack." And the Thunder God is ready for that. And he looks around. He doesn't see the Super Skrull. Gee, I wonder what's going on here.
"What witchery is this? My alien foe hath vanished. Even the Thunder God cannot cope with the power of invisibility. You cannot fight what you cannot see."
But of course, you know, you can fight what you can hear, but apparently Thor is too dumb to think of that.
"But I am far more dangerous than the famous invisible girl. for even though invisible, I can strike with the senses-shattering force of the thing himself, and he punches Thor.
Now, why didn't he think of this before? This is a much better plan than anything he's had yet. And he's here bashing on Thor, and Thor is being driven back, and the Super Skrull saying,
"You're dazed, reeling, and yet I cannot batter you into total helplessness. Therefore, I resort to another expedient, the all-consuming flames of the blazing human torch. By bringing the heat to Nova intensity, the strength shall be melted from your body."
You know, he's in torch form, and he's causing all this fire, kind of making a ring of fire around Thor. And Thor is like,
"Nay, even the true torch never dared such a feat. The planet Earth itself might not survive so potent a blast." And Thor is thinking to himself, "'Tis no longer the life of Thor alone at stake. All mankind doth now stand threatened."
Well, I don't know about all mankind, but certainly the people in the building and probably in the surrounding area. And he kind of jumps out of the Super Skrull's ring of fire, and the Super Skrull's like,
"Ha! You acknowledge my superiority! You seek to flee in blind and mindless panic, but there is no escape from the all-supreme Super Skrull. So you stop. You turn to face me. You are resigned to your fate at last. And now, Thunder God, farewell! Farewell forever!"
And he's forming a giant fireball in his hand, getting ready to hurl it at Thor. But Thor has another plan, and he deflects the Nova Blast with his whirling hammer, and then he strikes his hammer on the roof and creates a torrential downpour, because this is the power that he hasn't used for a while, but certainly is very useful against something that's on fire. And the water's torrenting down, and Thor's, "Hast thou so soon forgot? 'Tis the God of Thunder who doth oppose thee." I think that's bad grammar. I'm not really sure.
"'Tis mighty Thor, at whom's behest the storm doth erupt, the lightning doth flash, the heavens themselves reveal their awesome majesty. So be it!"
And there's lightning flashing around, and you know, the rain has put out the Super Skrull's fire, and Super Skrull's like,
"You've extinguished my flame, but the battle still goes on."
And Thor's like, "No matter, though it last till the ashes of Ragnarok be gone, the victor ever shall be Thor."
"Never, the advantage still is mine, for you can never know which power I shall hurl against you. Hurl one, hurl all, the Thunder God stands fast."
And Thor kind of goes to strike the Super Skrull with his hammer, but it's stopped by the Super Skrull's force field. And, you know, it's not really doing quite the trick. The Super Skrull's definitely on the ropes here, and
"no field of force can withstand my Uru mallet. Though mine eyes behold nothing, I strike again and again."
Which is a bit odd, because we can see the Super Skrull. He's not invisible. You know, normally when the Invisible Girl or the Super Skrull, or really even like Invisible Kid in the Legion of Superheroes for that matter, whenever something turns invisible in comics, you can always see it, but it's transparent, or you know, it has this sort of dotted line around it or whatever. And this doesn't look like that. This Super Skrull is actually just plain visible. So Thor is apparently blind here. And he's hammering at the force field over and over. And he says,
"I'll drive thee back until thy force field is forever shattered. But remember, I have many powers at my command." Well, four. "Where one may serve to no avail, I need only resort to another."
And he turns into, you know, the kind of rocky form of the thing and bludgeons at him. Except, once again, Jack Kirby didn't draw him kind of bricking up and looking like the thing. He just looks like himself. So I think Kirby got a little bit careless here on this page. And he manages to get Thor off balance, and he picks Thor up over his head, and he's going to throw him off the building before he has a chance to whirl his hammer around. And Thor says,
"But the son of Odin is no mere puppet. He requires but a single heartbeat with which to grip thee with his legs."
And he does this weird sort of judo throw and hurls the Super Skrull backwards into the wall. And the Super Skrull's like, no, you cannot fight back now. Not with victory so nearly within my grasp. And Thor's like,
"Again, thou hast made a grievous error. Never could such as thee triumph over the mighty Thor. And now let one princely blow put an end to this ignoble charade forever."
And the Super Skrull is whining here as a,
"I thought you were defeated. I was certain I'd won. How did this happen? What did I do that was wrong?"
And Thor's like, "Thou didst attack the God of Thunder. But since I am pledged never to take a life," which is this really stupid thing to tell your deadly enemy that you will not kill them. Just saying. Anyway.
I must find another means to protect mankind from the likes of thee forevermore. Thus, by the power of my Uru mallet, I do create an anti-force. Yeah, this is not a power that we've seen before, and I don't think we ever see it again. So it creates an anti-force, and it doesn't really explain what an anti-force is or what it does. But anyway, it creates some sort of a weird tractor beam force field sort of thing, which basically banishes the Super Skrull back to his ship. I don't know what's to keep him from coming back to Earth. And apparently, I know he does at some point come back to Earth. But he says, "Be gone then, Super Skrull. Never again will the planet Earth offer haven for such as thee." And he's like, "I'm helpless, caught in the grip of a force I cannot begin to comprehend." That's because he's a dumbass. "Return from whence thou hast come. Thy defeat is assured, thy banishment eternal. Thus speaketh Thor." And see the Super Skrull flying into his ship, and the ship flying away, and Thor is victorious. And Thor's, "The battle is ended, the cause is won, and I am very long-winded. And yet, a sense of unease doth lie heavy upon my heart. I feel yon foe was not the enemy true. Another there was, far more sinister, far more deadly. One who will never rest till the Thunder God be crushed." And as though he heard Thor, Loki is sitting on this planetoid where he is, and he's all angry.
"The Skrull has been defeated. Again, my most despised enemy has won the day. But it shall not always be true. I will plan again, till the victory is mine. Though it takes an eternity, I shall destroy the God of Thunder, and with him his beloved Earth as well." Then we have next issue's blurb here. "Next, thou must not miss the Enchanters." Ooh.
Compare this story to Baldur the Brave number one. Just humor me here. And this issue is action-packed. Now, basically, this issue is one big fight. There's really not a lot going on story-wise. But I do have to say, I mean, this is a big change from what we've had going on before. And now we have basic, just kind of whomping each other super villain action. And yeah, and it's well needed, I think. I mean, you know, it's nice to have one of these stories every once in a while that's just kind of, okay, you know, this is the super baddie of the week, and he's coming, he's going to womp on Thor, and it's a fan favorite that we haven't seen for a while, and we'll see who's stronger, Super Skrull or Thor. And like that's any contest. I mean, the result is rarely in doubt in these comics, obviously, especially 1967. Nowadays, maybe not so much, but generally speaking, artwork is very strong. There's some sketchy panels here and there, but by and large, pretty nice job. Some really nice moments here in the artwork, and some of the pages of the fight, page 12, for example, I think is a pretty dynamic one. Page 11, where the Super Skrull is stretching Thor to the building where he's standing, I think is a pretty cool. And of course, the one I mentioned before, page 9, where Thor's dodging the rooftop that's been thrown at him. And I just think that's at least that first panel is a really excellent, really dynamically composed panel. Maybe not so much the scene with Baldur and Odin in the throne room, but you know, just a big change. And you know, obviously, Jack Kirby being a far greater artist than Sal Buscema, I mean, it's very clear what's going on in the story. The transitions are very clear. The timing of them isn't always clear. But when you compare it to Baldur the Brave, where you have apparently weeks passing in the space of a panel or two, and the story doesn't really tell you, you just kind of have to pick that up on your own. You know, how much better is this kind of storytelling than that? And I think that's really, this is why Sal Buscema has always been kind of a second-rate artist, and Jack Kirby is the king. But it really does make me wonder about how different the Baldur the Brave miniseries might have been had Walt Simonson had a superior artist to work with. You know, somebody who had a little bit more of a storytelling sense than Sal Buscema. And I understand that Buscema is actually one of Simonson's influences, and I can see it in his art. And of course, he did good solid work for years and years, but he's no Jack Kirby. It's fun to imagine maybe what this Baldur the Brave mini would have been had Jack Kirby been the artist on it in 1967. Not that such a thing could have ever happened in 1967, but how that story would have been told differently had Kirby or somebody like Kirby had been the artist on that. So, again, you know, story-wise, pretty good. Dialogue, very Stan Lee-ish. Not a lot of Kirby in evidence here. So a little bit of it seems to be kind of Kirby-esque, but most of it is kind of too wordy. That's one of the things about Stan Lee is that he likes to throw in a lot of words into the word balloons. And really, whether they're needed or not. As much as I admire the work that Kirby did, especially things like The New Gods and Mr. Miracle and things like that, he really didn't have the same sort of dialoguing sense as Stan. That's one of the reasons why it's relatively easy to pick out the dialogue that Kirby came up with as opposed to the dialogue that Stan came up with. At the risk of aggrandizing Stan Lee perhaps more than he deserves, I mean, he was no Mark Twain after all, he was certainly more of a literary style writer than Jack Kirby was, in the sense of throwing in literary references, in the sense of just the structure of his plots and so forth. I kind of feel sorry for him in a way that he had to work with Kirby, despite the fact that this was a really, really, really good partnership, really strong work, you know, done in concert with Jack Kirby. But Kirby just has this knack for inconsistency and coming up with weird shit just kind of off the top of his head, and Stan has to write around that. And I guess sometimes they feel sorry for it. Sometimes it's genius stuff. I mean, sometimes it's the Silver Surfer, who was a character that Stan Lee didn't write into the script. It's something that Kirby just drew in and Lee ran with it. In a sense, one of Stan Lee's gifts is that he knows a good idea when he sees one. He doesn't always know a bad idea when he sees one, if you look at some of the recent stuff he's done. But certainly he was able to recognize when Jack came up with something that was a really good idea. But on the other hand, you come up with, you know, these weird powers like this anti-force, which has never appeared before, probably will never appear again, and quite frankly is kind of an ill-defined dumb power. Anyway, there is a 5-page Tales of Asgard backup, continuing the story of Thor and the Warriors 3 going after the evil, merciless Mogul. And we open up the story, which is called We Who Are About to Die. We have co-credits here of Stan the Man Lee, Jack King Kirby. Vinnie Coletta was the inker, and Artie Simek was the letterer. And we open up the story seeing a gang of, I guess these are the natives of the Mystic Mountain region of, you know, they're not in the underground world per se. But now here's a mistake right on the very first page. And it's like a huge honker of a mistake, too. Remember how they made such a big deal about the Mystic Mountain being underground? And that was it was really the Mystic Stalactite. But here the Mystic Mountain is actually a mountain. And there's like lava firebolts flaming down from a mountain. And the people are in the valley here, and they're kind of looking at the firebolts hurling down upon us from beyond the Mystic Mountain. And yeah, they're coming from behind this giant mountain. So clearly, Jack Kirby has, and Stan for that matter, have forgotten that the land of the Mystic Mountain is actually underground. And remember, on top of it was nothing but desert. So here we actually have a mountain, and these people are standing around in what looks like a cow pasture. So there's grass, and yeah, it's not consistent, folks. So yeah, what are you going to say? I mean, it's beautifully drawn, I have to say. All right, so this next page is really spectacularly drawn page here. In the top panel, we have people who are being thrown around by exploding fireballs. And, you know, it doesn't look like they're having a lot of fun here, folks. I mean, they're not having a lot of fun. There's an old man in the foreground who looks like he's kind of leaning up against a fence post. And there's this guy looks like he got hit in the butt by something, he's falling down. There's a young kid, he's carrying a baby, and some other people kind of fleeing, and the old man saying, "Thou may bludgeon us, Mogul, thou may beat us." Oh, I'm glad they're giving him permission. "Thou may slay us, but never shall we yield. Though our bodies be broken, our spirits remain unbowed." And the young kid is like, "Fear not, my child. The tyrant attacks because panic doth grip his evil heart. Well doth he know that soon he must answer to the mace of Hogun.
Mogul had turned against his own guard. He strikes those who serve him as mercilessly as those he seeks to destroy."
And this guy who he jumps on a horse, he's going off, I guess, to go for help and trying to bring aid. And he's saying,
Mogul hath loosed Satan's 40 horsemen. Even now they thunder through the night to trample the warriors of Asgard. But once Hakon and his fellows are slain, there shall be none to stop them. The 40 mounted demons shall overrun the world. And now I perish. Through some dark demoniac witchery, the mystical Mogul has stilled my tongue forever. And I guess he burns to death. And we then cut to Mogul's palace where he's watching on TV, which is really kind of what it looks like he's doing, by the demons of darkness. None are as mighty as Mogul. Hakon thinks to set his people free. He thinks to loosen the yoke of slavery which I have put over the land. But instead he has caused destruction without end to rain down from the skies. There's this giant cannon, I guess, which is where the fireballs are coming from. And Mogul's saying, "Keep firing! More, more, more! Let the doomed ones learn what it means to defy the rule of Mogul. Let firebolts be my answer to the helpless carrion." And this is a really great page, incidentally. It's a really well laid out page. We see Mogul there with his evil servant, and his servant's name is Sulabeg, according to the caption. And Mogul's like, "As for Hakon and his fellow Asgardians, they will fall before the next dawn beneath the thundering hooves of my demon riders. But hold! Who dares approach the mighty Mogul? What mortal creature doth presume to enter the presence?"
"'Tis I, master, thy loyal servant, Sulabeg. I have mixed thy potion as thou didst command."
"Servant, you doth flatter thyself. Thou art but slave to Mogul, as all who live one day shall be. Now the potion, I would fain possess it." Yeah, see, if somebody said that to me and said, "Oh, you're no servant, you're my slave," I'd say, "Screw you, I'm going to keep the potion for myself." Anyway, Sulabeg is not so inclined. He's,
"Thou must handle it with the greatest care, master. It doth contain the spotted plague. One slight sprinkling can fell a tribe entire."
"Well then, let me put it to a test. I must be certain that it hath been properly blended. I shall place a drop upon loyal Sulabeg."
"Nay, master, nay, mercy, mercy. Have I not served thee faithfully and well?"
And yeah, I guess Mogul doesn't really give a shit about that. And he kicks him aside and says, "Faugh, away with thee, thou base and servile fawning dog. Yon potion is for those who dare to defy, not for cringing, craven vermin such as thee." I don't know, using it on cringing vermin, that sounds like a good idea. "Thou hast served thy purpose, hence let thee be gone." And Mogul opens up this big door, and there's this big flat flying platform thing. And, yeah, it's kind of corny, actually. "Now the very hand of Mogul shall spread the spotted plague throughout the realm." And throughout is spelled wrong. "Open then the door wherein my mystical flying skyscraft stands." And yeah, this is that flat thing I talked about. "The time has come for sorcery, for witchery most sinister. In centuries to come, those who survive shall tell of Mogul's flight this night. Men will speak of it in hushed whispers, round countless campfires in countless lands. And in their mortal ignorance, when speaking to describe the craft I ride, they shall call it a flying carpet. Thus shall it be known throughout the endless ages." And yeah, it doesn't look a lot like a carpet, I have to say. But whatever he says. So finally, on the last page of the story, we come to the Warriors 3 and to Thor. And this is a great page, too. This five-page story has great layouts and very dynamic pages here. And they're fighting amongst the warriors. And I don't see Volstagg anywhere, so I guess he's off sleeping or something. And Hakon is there swinging his mace. And Fandral is arrow flinting around with his sword. And Thor, of course, whopping people with his hammer, as always. And Thor's saying, "In the hallowed name of omnipotent Odin, we do strike.
Back, ye denizens of darkness. Back, ye pawns of plunder. Back before the mace of Hakon."
Thor says, "The mace, the hammer, and thine own gleaming blade, dashing Fandral, have won the day. Now naught remains but the humbling of Mogul. But what of the voluminous Volstagg? Hath he been taken prisoner?" And Fandral says, "Nay, son of Odin, methinks he paused for a slight repast, and shall join us when the battle's done. But stay, what new danger doth now face us? An array of charging horsemen, led by the one who carries the battle standard of Hakon."
"Then my quest is nearly ended. No matter the odds, within the space of a dozen heartbeats, yon standard shall be mine. By the glittering spires of Asgard, this do I swear."
The horsemen draw nearer. Behold their evil visages.
He who carries the standard doth not lead them.
He is by them pursued. 'Tis the gravest danger of all.
Those who thunder towards us are demons incarnate. That's why they call them Satan's horsemen. Even the power that we possess may be trampled beneath the hooves of those who slay any who live. And that is Thor number 142. And yeah, exciting five-page Tales of Asgard backup. Cool stuff. Again, you know, some of the pages here look really good. It's page four, the page where, I mean, even though the quote-unquote flying carpet looks really hokey, it's still a great page of Mogul kicking the servant and then going out on this balcony and climbing on this flat flying thing and flying off. Great battle scene here of Thor and the Warriors 3. And particularly page two, where the fireballs are landing and smashing everything. I think, you know, these are a great issue. And generally speaking, I like this one a whole lot better than Baldur the Brave number one. Anyway, if you disagree, do you agree, whatever, you can contact the show. The email address for the show is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. Please feel free to contact the show. We do love to hear from people. Anyway, that is it for this week. I have a feeling I've kind of overrun a little bit. Well, you know, it doesn't matter. It's not like I have to stop at an hour or whatever. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. And of course, if you want to join us in our Facebook group, please feel free to do so. Just search for Radio Free Asgard in the searchy box and we'll be the only thing that comes up. So that is it for this week. We'll see you next time here on Radio Free Asgard.